Thank you for reading. Let's start with turn to your neighbour. Turn to your neighbour. Tell them a promise of God. Tell them, in fact, the promise of God that you are most looking forward to coming true for you personally. Go. Okay, pause there. I don't know what you said. Jesus returned, the new creation, to be free of sin, to have eternal life, end of evil, end of suffering, to be face to face with our God. And I wonder, do you think God will come through on that promise? That's the challenge of the 20 years of the Joseph story. Will God forget? Has it been too long? Is it too difficult? I remember the big theological truth of the Joseph story is that God has got this. God's got this. And we left it with Joseph 2 more years in prison. If you remember yesterday, he's waiting. And what we've got in this session is the upslope, what it looks like as God's promises come true, what God's got this looks like on the upslope. So we're on page 7. And let's just notice, first of all, that finally, all the pieces are in place. If God is going to save the whole region from famine, he needs one saviour of the world. Okay, so 13 years ago, he brought the saviour of the world from Canaan. He brought him to Egypt and he stashed him safely in prison, which is conveniently close to the centre of world power. That's useful. He also maybe gets 13 years of management apprenticeship. So Joseph spends 13 years running the prison. That's going to be quite helpful. Less important, but still crucial, is one forgetful servant. So we need the bad butler. And he goes from his power career down into prison very briefly, just enough to meet Joseph. And then he is placed right next to Pharaoh's right ear. Okay, that is where he needs to be. That's his job. He stands there all day pouring wine. And he has to be there on the day that Pharaoh talks about his dreams. Just think of the degree of control involved in getting that one man standing next to Pharaoh's right ear at exactly the right moment. God has got to control his career, his skills, his, I don't know, you know, wine nose, whatever it is he's good at, him being put in prison, him being brought back again, his choices, Pharaoh's choices, so that at exactly the right moment, he's there to say, Joseph. That's all he's got to do. That's his whole role, Joseph. But God needs him to be there. Then you also need Donald Trump, or maybe with the news this morning of the Chinese constitution changing, you need a kind of world powerful leader. The most powerful man in the world has to go to bed and have two dreams. God sends the dream at exactly the right moment. And then, of course, the big one in terms of God's control, you have to have 14 years of predictable crop cycles. Okay, so there has to be a famine 7 years away, 7 years of bumper harvest before 7 years of famine, threat and opportunity. And just think, how much control does God have for this to come true? I don't really understand, biology and climate science, but in terms of rain and growth and bugs or whatever it takes to make crops, to have 7 years of famine exactly when God says it. God is in charge of everything. Then the upslope, you just kind of smile as it all unfolds. So verse 1, as we just had read, there's a dream. In fact, two dreams. Verse 8, you have a total failure of all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men, and none could interpret. And at that moment, here he is. He's ready for his one line. The servant, I do know someone good at dreams. Joseph. And he's done. That's it. He remembers, and they send for Joseph, and out he comes. Here is his big moment, out of jail, and he tells the meaning of the dream, which being summarized is, we're all going to die. That's what the dream's about. Verse 30, after them there will arise 7 years of famine, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. The famine will consume the land. 7 years of famine in an economy where you keep 1 year's worth of spare grain. 1 year's worth of grain to plant the crops for the next year. So 7 years is total death. across the whole region. We are all going to die. Unless, verse 33, wink, wink, unless you know somebody, you know, all the wise men, they're not much good, unless you know somebody wise who might be able to help us with that. Okay, we're going to pause the story there. And as we did yesterday, Joseph's behavior as a believer is all about his trust in God. So applying Joseph's behavior. But this time, it's about how you trust God's promises in the good times. What Joseph does is he points the glory where it should go. Remember, the big theme of the book is God is in control. God is in control. And Joseph has an opportunity to steal that glory from God. Pharaoh says, I hear you are good at dreams. The butler says, we have this man who is really good at dreams. And Joseph could take the credit. But four times, verse 16, verse 25, verse 28, verse 32, God will give. God has revealed. God has shown. God has decided. God will do it. And just like yesterday, there is a challenge to trusting God on the downslope. And that challenge is, will you give up when things are going badly? So too, there is a challenge to trusting God on the upslope. Will Joseph give credit to God? Will he say God is in charge? And I don't want to labour it, I don't think that's the main point, but your groups, I guess about half the groups in this room are going badly, and about half the groups in this room are going well. Are you giving up? Are you taking credit? God is in charge. God is sovereign in the ministry we do. I think the bigger lesson from Joseph, though, here is one we hinted at yesterday. At verse 32, he has done the job that Pharaoh gets him out of prison to do. I think up to verse 32, he is giving the God-inspired, God-given interpretation of the dream. And at verse 32, I think most of us would stop, sit down, and shut up. But verse 33, Joseph is still speaking. Verse 33, now, therefore, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. And just think for a second what he is doing and compare it to what we do. He comes out with, remember, he's been dragged from prison moments before. He's had time for a shave. He's in court in front of the most powerful man in the world. He does his job. He interprets the dream. And then he pitches for the job of second most important man in the world. It's quite bold, isn't it? So let me see. Can you think of anybody? Anybody wise and able to understand stuff? Can you think of anybody in the room? Give me a job. Is what he's saying. In fact, more than that, he has a detailed plan for utterly transforming the economy, the political structure of the most powerful nation in the world. He has a tax rate in mind, 20% tax rate. He has a disaster plan worked out, 14-year disaster plan. He has some major building infrastructure projects about the grain barns and what they're going to do. He has it all there ready to go at that one moment in front of Pharaoh. If you believe that God is sovereign, that should not turn you into a sort of quiet, mousy, I wonder if God will do something type person. Okay, the doctrine of the sovereignty of God should not lead to peacefulness and silence and inactivity. Remember again the threat that Joseph's been under. He had his big moment. In chapter 40, verse 14, he saw God's sovereign hand at work. He saw the promises coming true. He said, remember me! And it backfired completely. Nothing for 2 years. He didn't remember him. But instead of learning that you really should stay quiet, otherwise you'll get embarrassed and fall on your face, he's been sitting there waiting, praying, you guess, for another opportunity to take an enormous risk because he knows that God is sovereign. There's a version of God's sovereignty, isn't there, that turns people into Christian puddings, basically. It plays very happily to my laziness and to my fears. God has a plan to save the world, that's true. He will do it anyway, regardless of what I do, that is true as well. So maybe I'll just sit here and watch Netflix until my brain rots. And that is where we're no longer doing what we should do. Belief in the sovereignty of God actually is the only way to be bold and take risks. It is astonishing if in your workplace group, in your university CU, in your church at home, if it is the people who don't believe in the sovereignty of God that are bolder than the people who do believe in the sovereignty of God, that is a very, very surprising thing, isn't it, when you think about it? Because those people, they don't believe God's in charge. They're just kind of stepping out, wondering what's going to happen, and they have no idea if it's going to go well or not. No theological reason to trust that things will work out well. They're just jumping into the dark, really. Or worse, they're just trusting that they're skillful and gifted and able enough for it to go well. But the people who know that God's in charge should be the people taking the risks all over the place. God's got this. So why shouldn't an enslaved prisoner ask to run an empire? You know, God's in charge. Maybe he'll say yes. What's the worst that could happen? You just go back to prison. I cannot stuff up my friend's place in heaven. If God intends to bring that person to his new creation, there is nothing I can do to prevent it by being insensitive or badly timed or getting the answer to the question wrong. I'm incapable of ruining that plan. So why not ask them now? And see what happens, and trust God, and pray. And I wonder, again, this is not really the main point of Genesis, but for leaders, as we teach truths, particularly knowing that some of you have been teaching God's sovereignty over recent weeks, and I guess struggling and battling with people in your groups over whether they like the idea or not, we often feel a pressure to apply, don't we, week by week by week. The kind of groups are there with their diary. It's like their diary's open. They've got Monday in front of you. Go, what are you going to tell me to do on Monday? And we feel the kind of pressure of, have I given them something small to do on Monday? Actually, over the last 7-8 weeks, have you applied the huge truth of the sovereignty of God in ways that will change their lives forever? It's a much better test of whether the groups are going the way. And actually, it's much more fun. So God's sovereignty, rather than have I managed to win the argument, have I managed to batter their brain sufficiently until they're just about agreeing, maybe the Bible does say God's in charge, even though we hate it and we're upset with it, have you actually shown them how radical, dynamic Christian living comes only from a belief that God's in charge? Have you shown how that sets them free from fear? How it means that nothing they can do can upset God's plans or destroy what God is trying to do? Have you shown them how it ends all guilt and about, you know, failed opportunities in the past and woe is me? Have you galvanized them into joyful action? Actually, again, the dialogue, what a great idea, Mickey wasn't born yesterday, to put dialogue events like in the weeks just after the sovereignty stuff. Let's pray. Let's go and ask our friends. Let's be terrified. Because God's in charge. That's the right kind of big application of some of these truths. And Joseph knows it. So he says, please, can I rule the world if you don't mind? And this time he tried it in chapter 40, but this time it's God's time. So yes, the answer is yes. Verse 37, this proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants, which is surprising, isn't it? Given a lot of them are the wise men. You know, one of them is number two in the kingdom. He's just been demoted. Verse 38, can we find a man like this in whom is the spirit of God? Let's appoint Joseph. And it goes very quickly from here, or we will anyway. Verse 41, why not be in charge of the whole land of Egypt? It's 11 words, and he has just become in charge of the global superpower. And you can work out what the equivalents are of the other things in this list. I think the ring is the credit card, or the kind of whatever, is it the red box? Whatever it is that enables the Chancellor of the Exchequer to spend all our money. That is what the ring does. The robe, notice he now gets a robe of just one colour, but it is better. Okay, that is the robe that says, I rule Egypt. He's got the fancy car. He's got the PR team shouting about how good he is. Verse 44 is, I think, more power. I think very few people in history have ever had this much power. Nobody in all the land of Egypt will move a hand or a foot unless you say they can. Just, some of you come from countries where there is a more robust approach to government. But even so,
I don't think anybody has had this level of power in the world for hundreds of years, this kind of properly autocratic imperial power. And then he has the society wedding. This is marrying Prince Harry or whatever it is, the society wedding. He puts his plan into operation and it succeeds at every level. There is so much grain, verse 49, until you can't count it because it is like the sand of the sea. Maybe just ringing about that phrase, that maybe God and his promises come true. And he has babies. Remember, babies were quite important in the baby wars. He has two babies. And then verse 55, he saves Egypt. And 57, he is ready to save the world. When the famine comes, Joseph is ready. The only place to get grain in the whole region is Joseph. He's the one. He's the only person with food in the whole place. And of course, what happens then? Dream number one from the beginning in chapter 37 comes true. Of course it does. There's no food anywhere else. They are starving in Canaan. So along with the rest of the world, one day a group of 10 brothers arrives and they come and see the powerful Egyptian with the food. They don't recognize him. Of course they don't. And there he is with his shaved head and his robe of just one color and his servants and his throne. And they bow down on their faces in front of him. Of course they do. The difference in power between them and him. But verse 7 of chapter 42, he recognizes them. And he pretends to be an Egyptian. And that's our cliffhanger for the next episode after we've done something else for a bit. Is he going to kill them? I think that's the cliffhanger. Joseph, remember what they did last time they met him? And now they are on their faces in front of him. And all he has to do is snap his fingers. And they are dead. It's an astonishing turnaround. For now, I just want us to notice the power in the promises. We thought about the control involved just to get one butler standing next to one bald-headed dictator. Just imagine the control and the sovereignty to get all of this in place, to save the Egypt, save the world, bring the brothers on their face in front of them. It means, doesn't it, that Joseph has not been an idiot for the last 13 years. 13 years of trusting God, 13 years of praying, 13 years of putting up with it as things went worse and worse and worse. Was he an idiot? Well, we've got a throne and a chariot and some people shouting in front of him as he goes that says, no, not an idiot. We've got, I don't know, millions of people not dead. To say Joseph was not an idiot. God has got this. That's the big overriding theological point. But what we've got to do now is to make sure we know how to apply that properly. How we apply from God has got this for Joseph properly to us. So we're going to do an exercise. Turn the page to page 8. And you'll see that Will Waugh stole this exercise from me. I'm slightly annoyed about that. So Will's game last night, just he did it slightly more colourfully. And what we're going to do, we're going to do an exercise where you get to make choices. Actually, unlike last night, you're allowed to press more than one button, so that would be better. What we're going to do, imagine that you are leading Sunday school next week. Is anyone leading Sunday school next week? Oh, it's disappointing. They've all gone back, haven't they, to lead Sunday school. Okay, imagine you're leading Sunday school next week and you are leading Sunday school on Genesis 37 to 50. Okay, that is the passage you're teaching on next week. You're going to be given some material to help you prepare. And I've got this from some genuine Sunday school material from the internet. It's pretty good. It's got some pictures on it of Joseph. It's got some games for you to do with the kids. It brings the story to life really helpfully. That would really help. And it helpfully it ends with the five main points. Okay, the five main points from the Joseph story. Okay, so A, B, C, D, E on your sheet. And what we're going to do, you're going to need a pen. If you haven't got a pen, there's some free pens at the front. What you need to do, I want you to put a tick or a cross as I read out the five main points from those notes. Just tick or a cross whether you agree with them, okay? We're not going to allow any conferring. We're going to be absolute silence, okay, exam conditions as we do this. You personally, tick or cross. We're going to go quite quickly. I just want your initial feelings. As a Sunday school teacher, do you think they've got something help from the passage or not? Okay, you can take more than one. I'm not as strict as well. Okay, so here we go. And they're going to come up on the screen as well.
Okay, ready? So everyone ready? Pen? Okay, so A, God made families so we could help find each other's talents. Okay, God made families so we could help find each other's talents. Tick or cross under A. B, the Lord is always present with us and watching over us. The Lord is always present with us and watching over us. Tick or cross for B. C, every place mentioned in the word has a special meaning. Okay, every place mentioned in the word has a special meaning. D, obedience to the Lord enables one to receive understanding. Obedience to the Lord enables one to receive understanding. And E, if we trust in the Lord and obey his commandments, his power will always protect us. Okay, Michael Yu has not put ticks and crosses. He's cheating. No pen. We're still going to want to hear your answers. Okay, so A, B, C, D, E. I want to get a very rough idea of the ticks. Okay, so this, remember, lying is wrong. Okay, so test of truthfulness, no peer pressure. Hands up for A. Who might use A in a Sunday school? God made families so we can help find each other's talents. Was that coughing or hand up?
No.
That was, okay, that was good. Okay. A, not very popular. B, the Lord is always present with us and watching over us. Okay, that's good. That's got a lot of ticks. Okay, that's good. Okay. C, every place mentioned in the word has a special meaning. No, okay. No one's gone for that one. D, obedience to the Lord enables one to receive understanding. Okay, there we go. That's a few for that one. It's less popular than B. E, if we trust in the Lord and obey his commandments, his power will always protect us. Okay, that's getting a number of significant hands for that one. Yeah, okay, as some people waving, I think that means they really like it. Isn't that what that one means? I think, yeah. Okay, good. What we're going to do now, you've guessed where we're going. What we're going to do now, we're going to look at those. We're going to say some of those are wrong. Okay, I hope you're okay with that. We had a staff meeting on Tuesday where we spent an hour and a half on why my Sunday sermon was wrong. Okay, so it's a kind of helpful exercise. I hope you'll find this helpful. Wrong, this is a Bible study point. Wrong is really useful. Have you noticed that Bible study only works if people are prepared to get the answer wrong? It's funny because when you move from being a group member to a group leader, you suddenly think all the group members hate you. All it is actually is they're afraid of you. They don't want to say the wrong answer. Whereas if you have somebody in your group who will say the wrong answer, those are the people you want to nourish and water and, you know, make do it more. Because the way Bible study works is you compare wrong answers and you improve and you get to a better answer. That is the only way that Bible study works. So here we go. We're going to love and nourish the people who got the answer wrong. All five of them, I think, are true, as in theologically true or nearly true. Okay, all of them are true and all of them are great things to tell seven-year-olds. Okay, there's no heresy here, I don't think, at all. But in terms of are they anything to do with this passage, okay, I agree with the gathered room. A and C, absolutely not. Okay, so C is simply not what the passage is interested. Place names. Some of the places are significant. The land of Canaan, okay, that is a special place. Some places are important. Bury me in the cave near Mamre. That is important because it's in Canaan. Egypt is becoming important as a place at the moment. But a lot of places are mentioned. Shechem and Hebron and Dothan and Gilead and Kezib and Timnah and Imnah and Beersheba and Goshen and Luz and Ephrath and Mamre and Atad. And really, we don't care at all, do we? And there's a load of other places that are not mentioned at all. You'd think would be important. You know, where does Potiphar live? Where is this prison? Which city does Joseph govern from? We don't care. They're not mentioned. Some of the places have meanings, have a significant name, Atad and Abel, Mitzrayim, but it's just not a big deal. We never care again. So C, I don't know what the desperation is there. Make the place names mean something. We don't care. A, what do we say about A? I think A is probably generally true, isn't it? In God's kind of generic creation of families. Families are there to provide safe places in which you can flourish and grow and fail without mockery and find each other's talents. That's true, but not this family. Okay, that is not what... What is Joseph's special talent? What is it that Joseph is good at? He is good at interpreting the future through dreams. What does his family do? You know, do they help him find that talent? No, they smack him on the head, throw him in a pit, and sell him into slavery for 13 years. Okay, that is not what this passage is about. In fact, this family, this is a family with four mothers, bitter rivalry between the kids, with a dad who's so far into favoritism, one of his sons nearly gets murdered. Okay, be like this family. That is not the message. Okay. So, B, D, and E, I think, have a bit more to them. But I think we can improve on them massively. Okay, so what you have on your sheet is a list of most of the main characters in the passage. Okay, most of the main characters in the story. And what I want you to do is what I call in Bible Overview the through the pinch exercise. Okay, in that Jesus is the center of history. He is, if you like, the pinch through which everything else passes in terms of meaning and understanding. And the way I'm watching Michael's face carefully, the way I think Bible Overview works, here you go, is that all of the details in the Old Testament, every single one of them, has value in the flowing story towards the Lord Jesus Christ. And what you need to do is not just kind of not that you jump from Atad to Atad must be really significant. You locate everything in the Old Testament story within the big categories of the Old Testament story. What is this doing in each book in the bigger flow of the Old Testament? What is it contributing to? Where does it fit on the flow? And then you look at where those big categories land in Jesus Christ and how they come out of Jesus, transformed and in the unfolding story towards the new creation. Okay, that's what I mean by through the pinch. Do these characters that I've got listed there, do they have a place in the big story, or are they just local colour? You know, the baker may not be crucially important in the book of Revelation, okay? He may just be local colour. But where do these characters fit in the main story? What happens when you trace them forwards to Christ? Okay, so I'm going to give you a few minutes with your neighbour. Have a go at that with these characters. Go. Okay, come out together. Let's see how we're doing. That's not very long, I know. This will be old news for you, but the single most unhelpful habit, isn't it, in Bible reading, that nearly every Christian has before they do an overview. So it's why you want people in your groups to stay at St. Helens long enough to do the overview. Keep them here. Promise, you know, whatever you need to do, keep them here until they can do the overview. The single most unhelpful habit I had was to read the Bible and think I was the hero on every single page. So there's Gideon. Gideon wins a battle with only a few people because he trusts God. I must be Gideon. I will win, whatever happens. And it comes out of a right longing, doesn't it, for God to speak to us, to speak to me personally as I read. That's a right thing to want. But it gets you into enormous trouble. So if you like that in Gideon, you turn on a few pages to Samson, and you know, you're the hero again, and you have to never cut your hair, and you have to sleep with a string of women and murder 30 people if you lose a bet, and set fire to 300 foxes, which obviously the Taylor family have done, but it, you know, that broader than that, it's hard to know. Or Genesis 38. Okay, Genesis 38, which I think we haven't got time for the song. That's really sad. Where's Catcher? Catcher has written a song. Yeah, I think we don't have time. Yeah, for Genesis 38. It's going to be tricky, isn't it, in 38? Who's the hero there? Like Judah. Is it Judah? He's one of the 12 tribes. Must be him. So, okay, I've got to be Judah. So what am I going to do? I've got to find a prostitute, sleep with a prostitute, or my daughter-in-law. That would do. Sleep with her. I've got to break my promises, be a hypocrite. It's, you know, that's very easy. Or, okay, maybe it's not him. Phew, okay. Maybe it's Tamar. Okay, she's much more positive. She's more righteous than Judah. Okay, got to be her. So what I've got to do is trap anybody who's opposed to me by pretending to be a prostitute. Okay, that's going to be a bit harder. Sleep with them, especially if they're my father-in-law, and get pregnant for that. It's going to be, okay, what is good? What? I can't be the hero. We need to give up being the hero. We need to teach our groups that is what TV is for. okay? Wish fulfillment narrative, okay? That's what TV is for. The Bible is about a bigger story. It's about salvation story, salvation history. And I am not the hero of God's plan to rescue the universe. Jesus is. So let's have a go. Let's do the easy ones. God, what happens to God as you put him through the pinch and comes out the other side? Yeah, thank you. Nothing. Okay, I'm going to fruitlessly click on this, but there we go. Okay, so God is the same. So what do we learn here about God? And this is where the excitement, the drama, the colour of an Old Testament story is fantastic for helping you understand God better. Your God is the same God that Joseph believed in his prison cell. Nothing has changed whatsoever about that God. He controls the future. He controls the weather. He controls food. He controls dictators and emperors. He can predict everything that will ever happen. He can protect those he wants to protect. Okay, those are absolutely true. And if you can, in the Old Testament story, you focus on the most important things we learn about God. So 45 verse 5, I know you weren't on that page, so the pages should be, God sent me before you to preserve life. Verse 7, God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive. Chapter 50, verse 20, God meant it for good to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. Again, a Bible study tip for you. If something is said at the end of a narrative in the summary and in the very middle at the big turning point when everybody is crying and the music is going, that is probably the big truth. God is in charge. God intended to keep them alive and save people. God is the same. Okay, so let's see what that's done to our options. Okay, so we knocked out A and C, didn't we? D, what do you think? D may not even be true. I think they're going from a verse in Proverbs or two, but I think D is not, you know, necessarily true. You could be obedient and stupid, can't you? That is possible. That's an option. Joseph, he is just good at the future. In fact, he's good at the future because God gives him that ability. That's what he says about it. Doesn't say I was obedient and so God has given me. He says God can tell the future. He was good at that before he did any obeying. He does do lots of obeying in the story, but they've taken two kind of separate bits of Joseph and added them together to make a nice lesson to make Sunday school kids be good. I don't think D is necessarily true. It certainly isn't a match to 50 verse 20, which leaves for us B and E. Okay, B and E. What's the problem with B and E? The always word, yeah, that's a little bit ambitious, isn't it? They're right about God, aren't they, B and E? Truthful about God's power, God's control. I think the problem is I am still Joseph in B and E. So those are both applying to me things that worked out truthfully in the life of Joseph. If you were to put them into longhand, B says, because the Lord watched over Joseph, even in prison, he will do the same for me. That's what it says. The prison experiences in your life, they will work out fine. Or E, put it into longhand, because Joseph trusted the Lord and obeyed his commandments, it means that you need to turn down sex with the Potiphar's wives in your life, because God's power will then protect you. And you will become the second most important man in the global superpower. Okay, which is a problem because not every Christian can do that. You know, you can argue about which is the most powerful nation in the world at the moment. I have maybe two candidates. And, you know, two of us maybe could do that. But a lot of Christians obey God, go to prison, and then get killed, including people like Peter and Paul in the New Testament. So, okay, let's go back to our list. And let's ask what you did with Joseph. Who's Joseph? You're so nervous. So nervous. Yeah, I think so. Let's see, is that going to come up? Yay, there we go. Yeah, if you look at the timeline of what is going on in the Bible overview, do we still, what do? People, place, and? Do we still do that? blessing. People place and bless you. We don't. Ruth Ann says yes. Michael says no. Something going on. In Joseph, so Joseph is part of the people of God, isn't he? He's part of the people of God, part of the 12 tribes. But probably bigger at this stage, he's part of the offspring crusher king theme. That seems to be a bigger deal in terms of what is going on with Joseph. You notice we've applied so far how Joseph trusts God, Joseph as people of God. But I think actually the bigger deal, it opens with a dream of all his family bowing down to him. He's going to reign. He's going to rule. Every time he's knocked down, he ends up ruling and blessing other people in Potiphar's house, in prison, all of Egypt, all of the Middle East. There is this huge focus on genealogy and on ruling. Chapter 48, we're not going to get very long with, but it's about which of Joseph's two sons will rule. And the answer is Ephraim, which ends up being the dominant tribe in 10 of the tribes of Israel. And we said, remember the king elimination thing, which of Jacob's 12 tribes will rule? And at this stage in the story, it's which one is on the throne? Joseph. So Joseph is God's king. He is Jesus. And in that sense, you suddenly, a whole load of details make sense. The strain, we were talking last night, a few of us, about cognitive dissonance, fancy word for discomfort, and the strain of trying to make me be like Joseph is pretty huge, isn't it? He's nothing like me. He resists sin. He goes on trusting God even when things go bad. He is, we'll see later, he is kind and forgiving and generous and trustworthy. He's Jesus. He has Jesus's character. He has Jesus's story down and then up. So where am I in the story? And this someone said to me a while ago with David and Goliath, but why is it you assume you're David rather than Goliath? And why is it when you're looking for a figure in the story to identify with, you pick the goodies, not the you? Maybe you're Potiphar's wife. That would be something, wouldn't it? Who am I? Who are we? Yeah, the brothers. That's much, much better, isn't it? Let's just put them on. There we go. The people of God, the tribes of Israel, where do they go in the story? They come through Jesus to the people of God today, Christians. So let's try that. What do I do in the story? If that's me, if that's us, what do we do in the story? See if this fits better. We get jealous. We want to kill Jesus. We want to get him out of the way so that I can steal his things. We make bad moral choices. We lie. We get scared. We run out of food. We need lots of help. We stand in Jesus' mercy, caught out and totally guilty for crimes that I deserve death for and unable to speak because I am so frightened. Okay, does that now, there's a role model I can relate to when you line all that stuff up. And in the story, again, a really good Old Testament question, where is the jeopardy in the story? Or where is the EastEnders moment? So as you go through, where is the moment when, you know, the drums play and you wonder if it's all going to work out? What it is that is going to destroy the promises of God, stop them from coming true? So the threat to God's promises, well, initially it's the famine, isn't it? I am the brothers and I am in danger because I'm going to die. In fact, the danger in the story is not the prison. Okay, that's where you get the kind of crazy Sunday school, you know, who are the Egyptians in your life? Where are you having, you know, who are the prisoners now? Is it, let's have some ideas, children. Is it homework, children? Yes, that's quite scary, isn't it? Well done. Is it, it's angry Mr. Jones who runs the sweet shop? Yes, a very good example. It's not Mummy. No, it's not Millie. That's naughty. That's sort of, you know, God will help you. The threat in the story is death, due to starvation, because the world is cursed and broken and full of suffering. Evil and death, the curse on the world caused by sin. That is the threat in the story. The brothers are all going to die, and they get rescued. They get rescued by Jesus, by Joseph. Just look back at our possible meanings again. Do you notice what's missing? Not a single one of them has a rescue in it. Not what, isn't that astonishing? And they all look like, you know, you voted for several of them. They look like credible lessons drawn out of the story. Not one of them has a rescue in it. They're all trying to make me be Joseph, which means they've all missed the fun in the story. The
fun in the story is the people of God are a shambles and get rescued by Jesus, by Joseph. Okay, let's have a go at some applications from today before we go off for some reflection. Remember, Genesis is programmatic, we said, for the whole Bible, which means it's a very early stage, but we are beginning to see elements of the rescue. We're here to learn about how God will rescue the world, what the shape of the rescue will be. And what is the particular thing? Well, it is how a person like Joseph is used by the sovereign God to rescue his brothers. I think that is the particular element at this stage we're putting into the story. So if you are impressed with Joseph, with his trust, with his attitudes, with his power, with the way the story goes for him, if you're impressed with Joseph, how should you feel about Jesus? It's my recommendation for the personal reflection time. Have a go at feeling about Jesus the way that this story wants us to feel about Joseph. I've put Philippians 2 on the page before, which tells us that in the end, everybody in the entire world will bow to Jesus. So the Middle East bows to Joseph at one point in history. Everyone who has ever lived, everyone you know, everyone you're afraid of, everyone that you care about, will bow before Jesus, and they won't just want food from him. The whole world will want to be the friend of Jesus at that point. And God has got this, is the career arc of Jesus. He has gone all the way down into death and all the way up to the right-hand side of God, number two in charge of the universe now. And all we're waiting for is for Jesus' footstool to show up. That's Psalm 110, isn't it? He's waiting for his enemies to be placed under his feet. That is the only remaining event in the Bible timeline. And the God who can put cupbearers by the right ear, the God who can bring famines from 7 years away, the God who can control dreams and the present of the world, has got this for Jesus. That's the person for whom God has got this, for whom God is in control, for Jesus and for the brothers who Jesus will rescue. Are you the brother or sister of Jesus? And are you impressed with Jesus? Do you think his story is just brilliant? How powerful he is, how it turns around, how it spins on a 3-day turnaround as he rises from death. I wonder, again, leaders predictably are tired at this stage of the year. Leaders may be asking, why are you doing this? Why maybe you've got 8 hours of prep to do when you get home this afternoon, ready for the week after? Or who are you doing it for? If your group doesn't really seem to care, maybe it just seems not very significant what you're doing week by week by week. Well, reflection time, focus on the one for whom you are doing this. And his name is not Mickey. Focus on Jesus and why you're doing it. One final note before we break. This is not actually the end of the story. We're still a bit Lloyd Webber, aren't we? There's still quite a few chapters that we've not done anything with, because saving the world is not actually enough. So here's the cliffhanger for the final talk. Chapter 41. Chapter 41, verse 57, we have solved the famine. And that is because the famine is the easy problem. The famine's really straightforward. It's just food. All you need to fix the famine problem is some food. And then you eat the food, and we're okay. All God has to do is 25 years of consecutive miracles to get a whole load of food in Joseph's care. And that's fine. That's all you need to do. That's easy. The real problem is in verse 51. Remember, the names of children are often significant. Joseph called the name of his firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my hardship and forget all my father's house. There's the tricky problem. This family, remember, is supposed to be a nation of godly people to save the world from sin. And putting the family together again, that's the hard problem. That's where we'll go after the break.